Good evening. I apologize for the somewhat long delay between shear number two and shear number three. It was due to some unexpected circumstances. I was trying to get my hands on some sources that I needed for this shear and thought I had them, but alas, I didn't. So I needed to wait to obtain those. And of course, COVID hit. Hit my family, but thank God we're all okay. That's why some of this had to get delayed. What I want to move on to this evening is a very interesting, a very fascinating collection, if you will, of shalos and tshuvos, of questions, of halachic questions that came about in the early 19th century. So we're moving ahead. Into the 19th century. Next week or next time, we will Bli Nedar talk about move on to the mid 19th century. But I want to focus tonight on again on a collection of sources from the early 19th century. So as we mentioned last time, there was a dearth of rabbinic leadership in America and the United States for a long period of time. As some may know, the first ordained rabbi, Rabbi Abraham Reis, arrived only in 1840, in this beginnings of the wave of German or Central European immigration that came to the United States. And with that immigration, with that German and Central European immigration, there was a trickle, really a trickle, a very light drip, if you will, of Orthodox rabbis, any rabbis that arrived in the mid 19th century. And those rabbis who we'll talk about, some of them as we go on in future classes, those rabbis begin to address themselves. They themselves address some of the halachic questions that arise during this time period. And so we have the beginnings of some halachic material from them. One important idea to keep in mind as we go through really all of these shiurim is that the evolution of the American rabbinate takes place. And with it, halachic independence comes along. So halachic independence comes along with the evolution of the American rabbinate. However, until the American rabbinate is able to reach points in their maturity or in their maturation, I should say, where they are able to address things and halachic questions independently, up until that point, there is at sometimes a total and it's sometimes a partial dependence on halachic leadership overseas, particularly in Europe. So what we will discuss this time is an interesting, an early example of that dependence. And for that, we turn to early 19th century New York City. So let's give some of the background that we'll need for tonight's shiur. One of the oldest and most prominent congregations in New York City still exists till today is Congregation B'nai Jeshurun, BJ as it's often referred to. Today, you may know it as a very large but non-denominational congregation on the Upper West Side. However, B'nai Jeshurun did not start that way. In fact, amongst B'nai Jeshurun's numerous claims to fame is that it is everyone's favorite. It is the first breakaway shul, first breakaway minyan, if you will, in New York, in maybe in American Jewish history, but certainly in the history of Judaism in New York. The first congregation in New York, as I'm sure many know, is Congregation She'eretz Israel, or as it's probably more commonly named, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. Still around, also on the Upper West Side today, it was and still remains, as its name quite explicitly gives away, a Sephardic congregation. They davened and continue to daven and conduct ritual life according to what is known as the Western Sephardic tradition, meaning the Sephardic tradition that came from Spain and Portugal. So in terms of the history of She'erith Israel, which is critical for this, She'erith Israel followed the Sephardi traditions, as we just mentioned. It was started by Spanish Jews of Spanish and Portuguese ancestry. However, the congregation rather quickly gathered Jews of various origins, including many Ashkenazim. So, as Jews go, this should not sound too unfamiliar, but many people became unhappy with the ritual practices of the congregation, and they began agitating to do things their way. In this case, not the Sephardi way, but they specifically wanted to do things the Ashkenazi way. And so what happened? In 1825, a group broke off from She'erith Israel and formed Congregation B'nai Jeshurun, which in their words would practice according to the, quote, German and Polish rite. I would like to emphasize that as opposed to its current identity, something, again, to keep in mind is that as opposed to what B'nai Jeshurun is nowadays, B'nai Jeshurun started off as a completely traditional, what we would call, although probably it's an anachronism, but what we would call a fully Orthodox shul. That's what B'nai Jeshurun started off as. We're not going to go into the history of B'nai Jeshurun. There are some interesting histories written about it, but that is definitely not our topic. So much like the Spanish and Portuguese congregation from which they broke off, B'nai Jeshurun did not have an actual rabbi to give it halachic guidance. There was a minister by the name of Reverend or Minister Kershit, I believe is how you pronounce his name. And he would perform many of the ritual duties. He would also answer, common, quote-unquote, easier halachic questions. And that was the leadership that existed for B'nai Jeshurun, much like in Spanish and Portuguese congregation in She'erith Israel. They also didn't have a rabbi. They also had a minister or the like that performed ritual duties. There was no one to answer shilos. There was no one to answer, meaning serious shilos, serious questions that came up, halachic questions that came up. There was no one to give them guidance. And so what did B'nai Jeshurun do? So B'nai Jeshurun turned to Rabbi Solomon Herschel, who was the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of England. We'll talk in a minute or two why they specifically turned to Rabbi Herschel, of all people. But that was the authority that they turned to, the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of England, Rabbi Solomon Herschel. So a little bit of background on Herschel very briefly. He lived from 1762 to 1842. And he was actually London born. So his parents came from, or his father at least, I believe, came from Galicia. But he himself was actually London born. And he served as chief rabbi for approximately 40 years. The next point, I don't mean this in a particularly bad way. Herschel was not known for his Torah scholarship. That's not to say that he was not a Torah scholar, but this was not his reputation around the world, right? We know that different rabbis get reputations for different things. Rabbi Herschel's reputation was not for his Torah scholarship. But for our purposes, what's important to note is that Rabbi Herschel in London was consulted by the leadership of Congregation B'nai Jeshurun on ritual and halachic matters. So he was the authority that they chose to turn to with their more serious questions. And whenever you're using shilos and tshuvos, whenever you're using responsa to inform us, not just about the halachic issues that are in the responsa, but to inform us about historical issues as well, you always want to ask the question, well, why does X choose to turn to Y with their questions, right? Why does either an individual or a community choose to turn to a specific rabbi, to a specific authority with their questions? Was there a prior relationship? Did that rabbi have a particular expertise in a particular area? There could be various factors that go into this. So the question is, why did Congregation B'nai Jeshurun in New York City choose to consult with Rabbi Herschel, Rabbi Solomon Herschel in London? So there is a very important, I guess very important to some of us, if you're into American Jewish history, it becomes very important. There's a history of Congregation B'nai Jeshurun, written by none other than one of their longtime rabbis, Rabbi Israel Goldstein. You'll excuse me, I don't have the years of his rabbinate in B'nai Jeshurun in front of me, although I believe he made Aliyah in something like 1960 or so, maybe even a little earlier. So you're talking first half or so of the 20th century. So anyway, Rabbi Israel Goldstein was the longtime rabbi of B'nai Jeshurun, and he was also a historian of B'nai Jeshurun. He wrote what is considered to be the history of a congregation of B'nai Jeshurun. And in that history, Rabbi Goldstein tells us that the congregation was founded primarily by English and Dutch Jews living in New York. So we said before that these Jews they broke away from Sheirith Israel, wanting to daven, wanting to conduct their services according to an Ashkenazi, right? According to Ashkenazi tradition and not the Spanish and Portuguese tradition. So where did these Ashkenazi Jews come from? They came primarily, says Goldstein, from English and Dutch families. So that helps us answer the question. The presence of such a strong group of English Jews made them feel an affinity with English Jewry in general, and not surprisingly, with the chief rabbi of English Jewry. And so they could have turned to many people, but because of this affinity that they had and these familial relationships that they had with English Jewry, they chose to turn to the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of England, to Rabbi Solomon Herschel. Just as an interesting side note, which is related, but Rabbi Goldstein, historian of B'nai Jeshurun, points out that during these early years, B'nai Jeshurun actually modeled or tried to model its services after the services in the Great Synagogue of London. So all of that is background and helping us understand the relationship between community and posek. So let's move on to the actual Shilas, right, to the actual questions that were posed to Herschel that were sent from New York to London. What types of questions did the members of B'nai Jeshurun direct towards Chief Rabbi Herschel? So in a really wonderful piece that was written by Rabbi Goldstein, he used the minute books of B'nai Jeshurun to collect some of the correspondence between the congregation and Chief Rabbi Herschel. So he didn't. He writes in the basically introductory paragraphs to his article that a lot of the original correspondence was no longer to be found. He thinks it may have been destroyed at some point. There is one thing to note, and I don't know if they have all of this correspondence, but much of the writings or the letters, etc., the correspondence of Chief Rabbi Herschel actually can be found at in the JTS library. But in any case, in this article, Rabbi Goldstein used the minute books of Congregation B'nai Jeshurun to reconstruct and to present the correspondence between B'nai Jeshurun, the members, the leadership of the congregation, and Chief Rabbi Herschel. So what types of questions did they ask? Remember, we said that the quote-unquote lighter questions were posed to and presumably answered by their presiding minister, Israel Kershit. So the ones that made it to London, right, the ones that were sent to England were of a heavier halachic nature, if you will. The questions are really spread over various areas of halacha. And we'll give a sprinkling just to give us an idea of the different types of questions that were asked. So the first question that Rabbi Goldstein lists that lists in his article is about the construction of a mikveh in New York. So the article does not cite the entire correspondence on the issue, but Herschel replied to the congregation in a way that we would expect somebody who is asked about the construction of a mikveh. He asks, right, not that he needs my approval, certainly not, but he asks all the right questions. He replies to the congregation by requesting information on the basics of mikveh construction. What materials were being used, what were the dimensions, how was the water supplied to the mikveh, right? So basic information that he needed in order to guide them to give them the proper guidance in constructing this mikvah in New York City. So that's the opening question. It's in Hilchos Mikvaos. If you go through the correspondence, if you go through this, what Goldstein cites in his article, so I personally think that even though he has questions related to Chametz on Pesach, and you know, kind of ritual questions that rabbis get, I think the most interesting issues, as I do in general, are those that are related to what we would call hilchos ishus, right? Questions related to marriages, divorce, as well as the offspring, progeny from various relationships. And I think that these issues, not only are they interesting and fascinating to read from a halachic point of view, but they're also indicative. They're very indicative and symbolic of the challenges of the small Jewish community, right? A very small Jewish community in the largely Gentile metropolis of New York City. And these were many of the tougher questions and tougher challenges that they were faced with. So let's give again a sampling of some of these various questions. So in one correspondence, Herschel issued a warning against conducting gittin, right, divorces without proper oversight. He cites how there was an individual who he heard was conducting and overseeing divorces in New York City, and he was suspect of this person, and he didn't think that perhaps he was the right and he was qualified to do it. And so he warns the congregation against conducting gittin and divorces without the proper oversight. In another correspondence, Herschel was asked about a case in which a man claimed that he was mekadesh a woman, that he betrothed a woman in the presence of two kosher witnesses, meaning the husband-to-be, right, claimed he was the one that came before the congregation, and he claimed that he had been mekadesh, that he had given a ring to a particular woman in the presence of two kosher witnesses. And then the man had to travel, and he was basically telling the congregation, well, you know what, while I'm away, you know, basically make sure nobody else tries to marry this woman, because she's mikudeshes to me, right? She's betrothed to me, and therefore, obviously, nobody else should try to marry her. So why was this a question? So the congregation had doubts as to the validity of the man's claim. So they sent all of this information to London. They sent all this information to Rabbi Herschel. And after receiving all the information, Herschel ruled that we should at least be concerned that the Kiddushin were valid, right? That this man's claim was a valid claim. And that if this betrothal, if this Kiddushin, if they wanted to nullify it, so then they would require a get, much like we would in any case of Kiddushin. In the lengthiest, and in my opinion most interesting, question raised in the minute books, Rabbi Herschel was asked regarding a case of Mamzerus. So what happened? So the story goes as follows. A member of the congregation of Bnei Jeshurun asked that the presiding minister, right, he came to the leadership of the congregation and he basically said, I want the presiding minister to be Mesader Kiddushin, to preside over the marriage of his daughter. Right, so he's the father of the bride-to-be, and he asked that the leadership of the congregation basically approve of the upcoming marriage and that the presiding minister be Mesader Kiddushin. So, right, all good and dandy, right? Everyone should be happy. But lo and behold, one of the leaders of the congregation, however, had been informed that the man's grandmother, that the grandmother of the father of the bride, right? So you're going back a number of generations already. But so the leadership, or one of the leaders of the congregation, had been informed that the grandmother of the father of the bride, so the great grandmother of the bride, actually had been mezana, that she had committed adultery, She was an Ashes Ish, right? She had been married at the time. She committed adultery, and that rendered all subsequent generations Mamzerim, that made them into Mamzerim. And as we know, Mamzerim are not permitted to marry just anyone. So they said to this man, well, we're not really sure that this marriage can take place because, right, kind of must have been a pretty awkward conversation, but they said, your grandmother was an adulteress, you're a mamzer, your daughter's a mamzeress, and therefore the marriage cannot take place. So what happened? So the man tried proving that his grandmother was not an adulteress, probably not the most enjoyable task. And then in an interesting, okay, so here we get to communal politics, and an interesting, perhaps expected twist in the story, since this man, right, the father of the bride, saw that the leaders of his shul, B'nai Jeshurun, would not agree to perform the marriage, so lo and behold, what does he do? He goes to the next shul in town. He turns to the leaders of Congregation Sherith Israel, of the Spanish and Portuguese shul, and asks them to perform, or for their minister to perform the marriage. So you might think that since Bnei Jeshurun was a breakaway from Sherith Israel, so maybe there was some animosity between the two. I'm sure at times there were, or there was, but in this case it didn't really come to the fore. So the leaders of Sherith Israel said that we're relying upon the opinion of the leadership of Bnei Jeshurun, right? At this point, we don't care that you broke away from us, but since you have your concerns about this upcoming marriage or this potential relationship, so therefore we're going to rely upon that. Just an important note to add to the story. This man, the father of the bride, in addition to claiming that his grandmother had not committed adultery, which was, you know, the most basic fact that he needed to prove, he also claimed that he himself had been married appropriately, kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, right, 100% kosher. He had been married in a 100% kosher way back in England, and his basically what he was trying to use that information for was to say, well, hey, if I was married kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, right, an appropriate marriage, in a kosher marriage in England, so it must be right that my grandmother was not an adulteress, that I'm not a mamzer, because the rabbis in England would not have approved of it if that were the case. So those are the facts of the case. All of this information was sent to London, to Rabbi Herschel, asking for him to rule in this case. Herschel responded, right, he reviews all the information, and he says a couple of things. He said, put it this way, the facts of the case and the question are actually much longer than Rabbi Herschel's response. So Rabbi Herschel responded, he says, first of all, it would have been impossible for the father of the bride to have been married in England with the approval of local rabbis. He says, I know the scene here in London, or I know the scene here in England, and what this man is claiming cannot be true. That had this information about his grandmother been known, which Rabbi Herschel assumes it was known, right? He assumes that it was known, or at least these rumors existed. So he says that he could not have been married in England with the approval of local rabbis. And so he ruled that the man must have been making up that part, and that the marriage of his daughter should not be allowed. That indeed, I guess the information about the grandmother was strong enough that they were concerned of allowing this marriage. And basically he's saying that the man and his daughter, etc., are to be considered mamzerim. So all of these different types of questions, right? So we said there are questions about the mikvah and questions about chametz on Pesach and more questions about marriage, divorce, etc., mamzerus, right? So all of these different types of questions show us really the array of issues that Orthodox Jews, again, Orthodox being somewhat of an anachronism for that time period, but we'll call them traditional, right? So all of these different types of questions show us the variety or the array of issues that traditional Jews were dealing with at the time. And when we think about it, they're really not so different than the types of questions that arise nowadays. We also have questions about mikvah. We also have questions about chametz. We also have certainly really complicated questions related to marriage and divorce. And so things were not all that different back then, even though they were such a small community, and that may have actually even led to some of these questions coming up in the first place. So two points emerge. I want to conclude with two points that emerge from all of this, and from these questions, and from our discussion. So the questions surrounding marriage, divorce, offspring show, like we just said, that things were not much different than they are now. And in fact, we know that the small Jewish community in the early years of the United States, of American Jewry, right? So the small community and communities, wherever they may have geographically been located, they faced serious challenges of intermarriage, right? So intermarriage is not a 21st or 20th century phenomenon or challenge. In many ways, it was a major, major challenge in the early years of the Republic and before the Republic, and certainly in the early years of the Republic. And so it's fascinating to see these challenges reflected in halachic literature. It's interesting to see how these challenges of the community, of the small community back then, were reflected in halachic literature. And it's also good to see, I would say, that there were people who cared about these questions, that they cared about preventing ruptures in the laws of marriage and divorce. It wasn't just a free-for-all. It wasn't just, hey, we're a small community, there aren't too many shidduchim to be found, so kind of, go marry who you want. But no, there were people that really did care about these issues. That's the first point. The second point, and again, with this we'll conclude, but the second point is the relationship between this early American congregation, B'nai Jeshurun, and a rabbi overseas. Why is this so important? Because B'nai Jeshurun was clearly aware of its deficiencies, namely that they didn't have halachic leadership. They were clearly aware of that, and they what's I think most important is not only were they aware of their deficiencies in halachic leadership, but they sought out a solution. Again, reiterating what I just said a minute ago, it wasn't just that they said, hey, we're a small community in the far-flung reaches of the Jewish world, we're ignored, let's ignore halacha, or let's ignore the halachic challenges. They could have said that, but I think it's important to note that they didn't, and that they sought out a solution to their halachic challenges. So they reached out, they developed a relationship with a rabbi with whom they had a connection, given, again, like we said earlier, the English origins of their many congregants. And this relationship that B'nai Jeshurun had with Rabbi Solomon Herschel, it's another sign, right, of A, the dearth of rabbinic leadership in America itself, right? Clearly the fact that they had to turn overseas is representative of the dearth of rabbinic leadership in early American history, early American Jewish history. But I believe that it is equally important to note that this dearth of halachic and rabbinic leadership was not ignored, and that there were ways in which people, individuals, as well as congregations, tried to address the gap. Thank you.